Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the next installment of the Alium Annals of Emergency Medicine Global Emergency Medicine Journal Club. And today I'm thrilled to introduce to you an international panel of experts here. We are coming from three different countries, and let me introduce you first to our superstar highlighted author of the day. We have here Dr. Stéphane Junot from University of Rennes 1 from France. Hello. Welcome to the video cast.
Hello.
Hello. We also have here from Canada, Heather Murray from Queens in Kingston, Canada. Greetings. Thanks for joining us. And then we have here Seth Truger from the University of Chicago, who is also the assistant social media editor of EM. And behind the scenes, we have Scott Kobner from New York University, who will be live tweeting from his handle, at S. Kobner. What I'd like to do is kind of structure out how this next 30 minutes is going to run, which is Seth will briefly give a quick rundown of the paper we're going to talk about, spontaneous pneumothoraces, and then we're going to go through three quick questions and have a little panel discussion, and then we'll just wrap up with quick pearls at the end for you to take home. So with that, let's go ahead and start off with Seth. Take it away.
Thank you for having me, Michelle and Stéphane. Glad you could join us. I'm really excited to talk about this paper. So this is one of the newest papers on some of the less aggressive management of pneumothoraces in emergency department papers. What Dr. Junot did with his co-authors was they talked about their four-year experience at their University of Rennes 1 in France, where they treated both primary and secondary spontaneous pneumothoraces who presented to the ED. These were large pneumothoraces, so basically about a 2 to 3 centimeter margin around the outside. There were 110 primary pneumothoraces and 22 secondary pneumothoraces, which we defined as having some underlying lung disease, pretty much COPD. It was pneumothoraces that was a little bit novel here. There had been some previous experience reported from some other centers, which were pretty much only in primary pneumothoraces. And then what else they did was put in pigtail catheters. They're respirologists, what we call pulmonologists here, who placed pigtail catheters in the traditional midclavicular line, second to third intercostal space. And then the other thing that was novel was the majority of these patients, 103 out of the 132, were managed as outpatients. These patients were sent home with a pigtail catheter in their chest with a Heimlich valve, a one-way valve, and then followed up every 2 days. And then when possible, the pigtail catheter is taken out. There's an 83% success rate where the rest of the patients needed something more invasive, usually a VAS with pleuridesis, and a 26% one-year recurrence rate. So overall, this is a pretty good study. It was an observational study where everybody was getting the same intervention for the most part, but showed that basically there's pretty good success rate of managing people with some hardware, with basically a pigtail catheter, what's essentially a cortice in the chest for the pneumothorax, and not a large chest tube and not an admission for the most part.
So I'm wondering about the use of aspiration in some of these patients. The British Thoracic Society had put guidelines out in 2010, which had aspiration for large spontaneous pneumothoraces as the first intervention. And I'm wondering if aspiration is used in your center and why you didn't have that as part of your protocol, or why your particular hospital hasn't gone down that road.
Yes, actually we didn't use aspiration for two reasons. The first one was it seems easier to set the catheter and send back home the patient quite immediately, because waiting was less than 2 hours before going home, and without any control, no X-ray. And the second one, if you have to aspirate, because you can set the catheter and aspirate the pneumothorax, what is recommended in the BTS guidelines is to control, check again the chest X-ray. This is between 4 to 6 hours later, and so it delayed the discharge of the patient. So it seems easier to put a catheter for 100% of the patient and send them back home and see them 2 days later.
And can I follow up on that? Your paper had said that safety of sending someone home with a chest tube was felt to be better than the safety of sending someone home after an aspiration. And I'm wondering about that. I guess I'm wondering what the safety improvement is with a chest tube in versus an aspiration.
Actually, what seems to be really reassuring is that when you send a patient back with the tube and the one, there can be a new pneumothorax. It can be aggravating. Instead of if you perform the aspiration, and even if you control the chest X-ray for 6 hours after and you say everything is fine, in the few hours later or even 1 day after, the pneumothorax can come back and be more dangerous than letting the one-way valve with the catheter.
I see. So it sounds like you're worried about kind of more the delayed recurrence of the pneumothorax from the aspiration that may go unnoticed by patients. I think that the studies I was looking at is kind of variable about what this recurrence rate might be. So it would be interesting. I think on the blog we had mentioned about, well, it would be interesting to do a three-arm study to look at exactly this head-to-head with pigtails. And that is a good segue, actually, in terms of, let's segue over to Seth here for the second question.
So first, let me, a little bit of background. I'm going to summarize some of the comments we got. I think they fell into essentially four different groups. First is the big question that I think a lot of people had was follow-up. Here, you know, these patients all had follow-up every 2 days, so day two, day four, day six, and only 11 patients, I think, were lost to follow-up, which is a really good follow-up, and I don't think a lot of us, especially in big urban centers in the States, can guarantee that kind of follow-up. So there's some discussion about, do you need to work with the respirologist or pulmonologist to have a follow-up clinic? Are we going to have these patients come back to the ED? And that's just from the institutional side. And then from the patient side, you know, we've all seen patients who have stitches that stay in for a couple of weeks. Are the patients going to be trusted to be able to come back? Some of the other issues were the failure rates. You guys reported a 26% recurrence at 1 year, and I think it was about a 17% failure rate initially. One of the commenters, another chest surgeon, mentioned like a 50% recurrence rate at 4 years, which might be the same curve. Heather already mentioned that there was a lot of discussion about aspiration versus placing these. That's where some of the other similar studies are looked at. And then lastly, there was a lot of discussion about who's placing these pigtails, whether it's the emergency physicians, the pulmonologist, or an interventional pulmonary service, or the chest surgeons. Did you want to address any of these comments?
Yes, I think I will begin with the last one about who set the catheter. Actually, this study published in the Annals was performed in the Lorient Hospital because they got the catheter before our own center. I've done the same protocol in our center with a different technique, actually, because we don't have any pulmonologists on call, so they are not here at night, and pneumothorax occur day and night. And so at the moment, in our center, this is the emergency physicians who set the catheter. The pulmonologists see them every 2 days after. And it's working quite well with a specific form with fax, and pulmonologists in charge for the day just have to schedule the appointment for the outpatient clinic. There is good things and bad things about this. And we talked with the pulmonary physician from Lorient, because there are five at the moment, and they still... because they are on call in this specific hospital, they are still setting all the catheters for pneumothorax at their centers, and they said that there are only five physicians to set the catheter, and so they've got a great experience with it, with no complication, as mentioned in the paper. So in their center, it's working. In our center, we couldn't do that, and we are doing with the emergency physician. And as specified in the blog, every emergency physician know how to put a central venous line and use a Seldinger technique, so he's able to catheter. That's what we think, and it's working. But there is some little things to be more accurate, because there is a lot of emergency physician in our center. There is a lot of rotation. The registrar change every 6 months. Some senior doctors also change every 12 months sometimes. I think that from an educational point of view, we have to be very strict on the formation of all these doctors. And there is some little point, very specific, on the valve and how to put the valve in the right way, because that's what we have seen in our center. Sometimes it was in the wrong way, so it's not working. It's rare, but it happens. Just to know how to put the catheter not too long in the chest, this kind of little stuff, but it's working very well. And the more nice thing is about the patient who can go home, because most of the time this is a young patient for the primary, which is the main kind of pneumothorax, and it's quite good to have so many patients managed ambulatory. For the next comment about stitches sometimes staying a long time in patients, what we observed in our experience with patients with pneumothorax, even with secondary pneumothorax in older patients, sometimes in smokers with COPD, not so reliable on the appointment. But with the pneumothorax, they understand that the lung or the pleura, there is air and there is. And we didn't have any patient lost of follow-up before extracting the catheter. In the study published, the loss of follow-up was because of this is young patients moving from in another part of France. But even here in Rennes and in other cities where this kind of management is beginning to be introduced, I didn't hear any colleague telling me that they lost a patient with the catheter in place. So I really don't think that it should be something bothering with this technique.
Well, thanks for sharing that insight. I think what is interesting that you bring up is that if we were to implement something like this at our shop, we have to pay a special attention to the competencies of the trainees that we might have at our site to ensure some consistency and quality of the procedural placement. That being said, I think, at least in the States, U.S. EM residents are very competent with chest tube procedures, and that is a very standard practice. So hopefully it's very translatable. I think most people would put it in the mid-axillary line, fourth to fifth intercostal space, and I think if we were to shift it over to more of the anterior version, it would require some training, at least in the States, because that sounds like that is your primary approach, correct?
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of variance with that. But let's skip over to the third question, which is, you know, I don't know about you, but I love movies, and on the DVDs, they have a second track, which is the director's cut, behind the scenes, and I would love to hear from Stefan anything that didn't show up on the paper that you would care to share with the audience.
I know that there is two specific cases which were more than just from a medical point of view. One of the patients was the best man for a wedding, and he got a pneumothorax just a few days before perhaps 2 days before the wedding, and he was able to go to the wedding because of this kind of management. Another patient was having this pneumothorax just the day before the A degree, one of the exams. In, I think it was a French one. That's the same. We set the catheter, and he was able to go to the exam and to perform it instead of being admitted in the hospital with a chest tube. And so that's some little benefits which are not medical, but still very interesting for the patient. So
those are great stories. I think many times when we look at these studies, it's all about the science, but we need to factor in, I think, patient convenience, cost effectiveness, you know, missing life events. How do you quantify that? And these are fascinating stories to help us ground us in these studies in some sort of reality. So thanks for sharing those stories.
Just to add for the, with all the little defects and the problem we have encountered, we have performed a checklist with a specific form to be filled by the physician or the nurses in charge of the patient just before letting the patient go home, with checking of the valve, the one-way valve in the right way, checking all the tubes were not kinked, and all this kind of stuff. So there is a 10 to 12 little box to be filled and to be sure that everything is fine. So with this kind of little form, to be sure that there is appointment with the pulmonary physician and this checklist before releasing the patient, I think that this management is quite implementable in different places.
Can I ask, is there a specific protocol that you use to train your emergency physicians? Have you come in and done any kind of on-site education for this, or is this a skill set that they already had and you're just employing the protocol with that in place?
Yes, most of the time in our center, we just meet the emergency physician and the senior one, and we with some slides of PowerPoint just to explain things. But most of them, they already know cell digital technique, where to put the catheter. It was just some insisting on the valve, the kinking, and also on it's not necessary to perform a chest X-ray after putting the catheter. And I know that it was with the reviewer and with some of colleagues, sometimes they prefer to perform the chest X-ray. We don't think that it's necessary, but we know that even now in the emergency department, it's performed around one-third to half of the patients. This is reassuring for the physician, I think. So the main point is to let the patient go back home. So I think that can be done.
Question for you about, you mentioned the checklist. I think it's always a great idea when you're implementing a new innovation or new standard within your institution. And what I love about these virtual meetings is that, you know, would there be any chance that, is this a public document for someone who might be starting this out, that maybe we could share that and take a look at what your checklist looks like?
I can definitely send it to you.
Great. And then I'll upload it to the blog so we can roughly see what this checklist looks like. Seth, did you have a question?
Right. I was just going to mention, Heather and I had actually been chatting about this a little bit when in the preparation, and Stefan, you just mentioned the follow-up chest x-ray. I think you're probably right, and your experience has shown that it's really safe to manage these new pigtails without a chest x-ray confirming placement. It just seems like that would be a very uphill battle in North America to get people to discharge somebody with new hardware in the chest without a chest x-ray. It's hard enough to convince people that ultrasound is sufficient for pneumothorax, and the patients were worried about everybody here still uses chest x-ray, or not everybody. A lot, too many people here still use chest x-rays to confirm central line placement and other things like that, and I think that would just be a big uphill battle for us. I think, again, you're right, and it would just be a tough fight.
No, you're probably right, and the main point not doing the chest x-rays, because when everything is set with the plast on it and you just check and see that the valve is moving with the respiration, you know that you're in place. And the second point is because when you just put the catheter, actually the lung is not re-expanding straight away. And so sometimes the physician want to say, well, this is 2 in the morning, I will wait 8 to let the patient go back home and perhaps do another chest x-ray. And it's to avoid also this kind of things, and it's not necessary.
I just wanted to ask about, there were 2 patients in your series that had the catheter kink, and yes. I guess I'm wondering, you know, to me that would be the most worrisome complication, is occlusion of the tube with still a residual pneumothorax and possibly a non-healing or non-closing bleb. And I guess I'm wondering how that would be the main sort of safety concern, and I wonder what your thoughts are about potential other complications or issues related to kinking.
Because of all these little problems, we at the moment, for a patient coming for a primary pneumothorax, we've got several forms. The checklist before letting the patient go back home to be performed by the nurses or the physician. We already talked about that. There is the form for the appointment, which is a fax internal of our hospital. There is a document with information about, how do you call it, in the seas and with the oxygen bottle, this kind of thing. And the last form is about all this kind of thing. We give this form to the patient, and there are several lines, and one of them is just to check if the valve is moving with the respiration, and when there is a father or the wife of the patient, she can check it and have a look of it to be sure that there is no kinking of the catheter, and she can look at it, and when you put the plaster on the tube, just to be sure that you can see the tube of the catheter and check it. If there is liquid, because we have seen that in the catheter, just to be sure that the patient is not blocking the valve to avoid the liquid to spill. And because we've got one patient who put some plastic band, adhesive band on the valve to avoid the leaking going. And so everything is written on this form, and I can send it to you also for the blog, if you want, and there is some all this stuff to avoid the patient to do wrong things with the catheter.
That would be great if you could send it along. I agree. It's amazing how creative patients can be about the numbers that can occur with hardware. So any upfront work that you already have would be great to share amongst our viewership. But let's just wrap up here, and maybe you could leave us all with one take-home point you'd like the listeners to come away with, and I'll start with the star of the day here, Stefan, first.
Perhaps the philosophy of this stuff, which was the first to think about it, was Laurent Soyer, Dr. Soyer from Lorient, and the way was you've got a primary pneumothorax, you put this kind of catheter and sending that back home, and with the same protocol for every patient, and it's an easy way to manage all these patients. So I think the take-home message is it's easy, the same way for all the patients. For the secondary, we don't have enough patient to be sure that it's really safe, and we're working on it at the moment. But clearly for the primary, it's really easy and it's working.
Great, excellent, well said. We have Seth next.
Sure. So I think you guys have done great work. I think right now we've got some pretty good data from a couple of different case series that pigtail placement is a really safe way to manage simple pneumothoraces. We've got some good other data that aspiration works pretty well. We know chest tubes worked well, but are probably more invasive and require more admission than we want. It would be great to have a comparison study going forward. So hopefully you're working toward that. And really, I think Jerry Hoffman and Rick Bucata talked about the Masango paper that you cited in yours at ASEP a couple weeks ago. And Jerry Hoffman put it really well that right now we know we can manage pneumothoraces, pretty much. Whatever you do, you'll get about an 80% success rate. So now that we know we can do it in a couple of different safe ways, the key, I think, is going to be the initial management is easy. Put a drain in, put a pigtail catheter in, do what you can to get the patient home, aspirate it if that's what you can do at your shop and don't have anything else. The key is going to be the follow-up. Work with the pulmonologist and respirologist to get that follow-up and talk to the patients so they know what to look out for and so that they're not, putting tape over it or anything like that.
So true, so true. Heather, what do you have?
I mean, just to follow up with Seth, we're looking forward to seeing some kind of comparison study. I know that a number of Canadian centers are doing this, putting pigtail catheters in and discharging patients for home follow-up. And I think because the outcome, the success first pass outcome is going to be comparable across all of these different therapies, I think the patient-oriented outcomes are probably going to be the thing that is most important for us to track. Satisfaction, pain, ease, convenience, all those kinds of things are probably going to be the thing that seals the deal in this sort of a trial.
Excellent points, everyone. I think all of you guys are well said in these take-home points. I think it's about whether this technique is generalizable to your setting and to your patients. But it's always nice to know of different options that are available now. It's not chest tube is not the only answer that's potentially on the horizon. So stay tuned, and I look forward to see what kind of research comes out of this. But thanks, everyone, for joining, and we'll sign off. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.